Turn with me to 1 Corinthians 13. And this is one of the great challenges that I will face in this class, because most of you are very mature Christians. You've been Christians for many years. And so when you come to 1 Corinthians 13, you're thinking, well, okay, what are you going to tell me that I don't already know? You know, I've been in Bible study fellowship. I've been in precepts. There is a whole, and this may be one of the few chapters that many of you have memorized. And so it's like, okay, what are you going to tell me that I don't already know? And first of all, what I want to say is that sometimes when we come to 1 Corinthians 13, we think of that picture on the left. Perhaps you even have a plaque in your home that, you know, love is patient, love is kind, love is not envy, love does not boast. No doubt you have been to even wedding ceremonies where there were people that you weren't even sure were Christians, who maybe were in church for the very first time just to get married, probably don't even own a Bible, but nevertheless would oftentimes read this particular passage. And so when we think of this, we think of this as kind of the universal passage about love. But what I want to try to do is remind us that as we're going through this, we're talking about why did Paul teach and preach this in ancient Corinth. And so I put that other slide up here to show you one of the pictures that comes from some of the sculptures that came out of ancient Greece about their view of love. And of course, we recognize today the word love has been redefined rather dramatically, hasn't it? Marriage has been redefined rather dramatically. And if, again, you're in the Greek culture and Aphrodite is your goddess, you can see that he probably needed to do some clarification as well. But the primary reason, as we will see as we go through this, is that Paul is really inserting this rather small chapter in there in large part to break up the teaching he does in 1 Corinthians 12 on spiritual gifts and then the teaching he does in 1 Corinthians 14. And so it is an intentional interruption. So what I'm going to try to do is, if nothing else, maybe share a few things so that even if you have exegeted this passage and memorized it, maybe add a few things that maybe you haven't heard before. But then if you look at your handout, and let me just mention, if you're a visitor today, if you notice at the bottom of the handout, it says PrestonWoodExamine.org. We also have a way in which you can follow this later on. I wanted to do some real good application so that we aren't just studying love in the abstract, but how do we apply love in the midst of our relationships and in dealing with conflict and all of the rest? And this fits very well with some of the things that we had this morning, because you might have seen the interview that Jared Stevens did with Gary Thomas, an individual, by the way, that I've interviewed on numerous occasions as well. And so we're going to even pull in some of the material from his new book on Cherish and also some other books as well. But as I point out, and you can see this on the screen, what Paul is doing here is putting this small insertion. It's almost a parenthetical statement that as we're talking about spiritual gifts in chapters 12 and 14, in chapter 13, puts this in here to remind them of the importance of love. And here they were obsessed in Corinth with learning and of secret knowledge. This idea of gnosis came to be the Gnostic gospel and heresy that came place there. And so he's really trying to interrupt some of the teaching on spiritual gifts to help them understand that the gifts aren't the issue, it is the love that you have behind them. And instead, godly love is the most important characteristic of a believer and one that makes you truly spiritual. And he really wants to also, as we'll see in the second section here, try to emphasize that love is not transitory. Love is permanent. It will be carried into eternity, whereas many of these spiritual gifts will cease. And so we'll talk about that, especially more next week when we get into that. And while the gifts are important, while they should be exercised, they should strive to experience and express love, because really that's the only particular aspect that actually continues on. We're going to do something we don't normally do. We're going to start in the last part of the chapter. These chapter divisions were added later on by a Frenchman, interestingly enough. He did a lot of these chapter divisions as he was riding on horseback. And I think this is one case where the horse stumbled, because actually chapter 12, verse 31 belongs on that first part. But this is the way the chapter is. So we'll start with chapter 12, verse 31. and I will show you still a more excellent way. If I speak the tongues of men and angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all that I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And so again, a very familiar passage, so I'm going to move through some of this quickly so we can get to our application. But first of all, begins with this phrase, I will still show you a more excellent way. Matter of fact, some of you in this room have read a book which has the title, More Excellent Way, written by a pastor out of Georgia. And then he now, in a sense, gives us, if you will, a reset button. Been hearing a lot about a reset button this last couple of weeks when we talked about Russia, but this is a reset button on the issue of spiritual gifts. And he wants them to kind of pause and ponder and think about the motivation behind the way in which they're manifesting those spiritual gifts there in ancient Corinth. Let's look at the first three verses here. Here, first of all, exposes where the Corinthians usually say their significance is. That is, what they say, what they know, and what they do. And so in a culture that's really obsessed, remember again, as I've shared in previous weeks, you would have speakers, traveling speakers come through, and the great orators would be given lots of attention. They would be given money and all sorts of things. And so he's even saying here that you're in a culture that's impressed with people that are impressive, they're eloquent, they're able to use rhetoric in a very effective way, and even if they're speaking in tongues, what he says in verse 1 is, even though they can do all of that, it's worthless if they don't have love. Speaking eloquently or even in tongues is useless because it's nothing more than just like a clanging gong or cymbal. Then in verse 2, he takes on the issue of the prophetic ideas. And again, these are issues we're going to look at more in detail next week. Speaking in tongues, prophecy, and those kinds of things. But again, if they understand all these mysteries, it's still pointless, he says, without love. Possessing intelligence and insight and knowledge, the things that they valued so much in that Hellenistic Greek culture, does not impress God if you don't have a loving heart. And then finally, in verse 3, he deliberately exposes them who may not say or know much, but consider themselves important because of what they do. And that is, he says, you know, those who would like give away. In other words, if you're just incredibly generous, if you're one of those individuals, if you go down to downtown Dallas and you see their name on the hospital or their name on the university or their name in even in some of these churches in the stained glass or things like that, and great, doing good works and they're generous and everything, well, that's nothing if there's not love. And then he even talks about delivering their body up to be burned. There's the idea that even if they were martyrs for Christ, that doesn't mean anything unless they had genuine personal character, unless they really had love. So what he's trying to do here is it says it doesn't matter what you say, it doesn't matter what kind of actions you do, it doesn't matter if you're a do-gooder, that even acts that look like amazing expressions of love could still be motivated by self-promotion instead of genuine concern for others. And so I think it's a great reminder, even before we get on to verse 4, that in these first three verses, it's kind of a check on our own spirit. Why do we do things? Do we do it out of love? Do we do it because people will give us adulation? Do we do it out of self-promotion? What are our motives? And I think, again, as we have talked before about appearing before the judgment seat of Christ, there are certain things that we will do that will just be burned up. Because from the world's point of view, these were really good acts, and these people were doing good things. And these individuals even went and suffered greatly. But if they weren't doing it out of love, that really causes a check in my spirit. So even as we get into now the more famous part of this passage, we have to recognize that Paul is reminding them, and I think ultimately us, we need to check our motives and evaluate why we do what we do. Well, then we come to the most famous passage here. I would imagine that even non-Christians know these verses here because they've seen it so often in plaques, or they've seen it in Facebook memes and posts and things of that nature. And here what he does is again say that spiritual gifts are of great importance to them, but again, you should necessarily ask, what is your motivation? And so he does kind of like you do in a journalism school. Who, what, when, how, where, what, why? That is, why they want them should be more important than what the particular spiritual gifts might be. Why do you desire these gifts? So that you can get adulation? So that you can stand in front of a group and impress them? Or do you want them so that you can use them to build up the body of Christ? And he makes it very clear that the motivator and really even the foundation of these spiritual gifts should be what? Well, again, it is love. And then they understand that godliness should be a preeminent goal. And he now begins to express that, as we point from verses 4 through 7. To communicate love effectively, Paul personifies love using 16 verbs in just these three verses to really begin to explain what it is. And he wants to show them not simply what love feels like, but also what it looks like manifested in the body of Christ. And in a world today where love has been so redefined, I was talking to the producer of our Probe radio program, and he said, you know, when we even use the word love now, we've got to maybe define it in our radio program. And he said, you know, I was hoping that maybe you could even come up with a radio program that dealt with the word peace, because that's at least one of the last few words that you find in the New Testament where I think Christians and non-Christians kind of know what the word peace is. But when we use the word love, we live in a world where it's just completely so redefined as to almost have no meaning today. So Paul helps us out with this both in the negative sense and in the positive sense. And that is, he negatively chooses verbs to precisely show these believers what does not manifest love. It does not envy, for example. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable. So he first uses lots of negative words to say what love is not. But then he comes back and positively uses verb choices to dramatically describe the loving nature of God to each believer. And when we look at these ideas of love, we really can understand what God's love is all about. That God's love is so dedicated to our goodness and so persevering that we might sometimes fail to understand how much God's love is. And we've had Max Lucado speak here before. And Max Lucado uses this great story. By the way, he's just a really good writer. But in one of his books, he tries to explain God's love, and he uses this very true story of this father who, when there was an earthquake in Armenia, races to his son's school. And as he gets to the school is in rubble. And so he heads to that part of the school in this massive earthquake and begins to tear off the stones and the brick and everything. And first of all, he is stopped by some of the emergency workers saying, you know, there's no chance because this has crashed down upon them. But he keeps doing that. And then pretty soon the parents say, look, you know, you just have not faced the fact that our children are dead. Please don't do this anymore. And so he is now, it's about 18 hours into this process of still pulling these stones away. The police now come and tell him, this is not safe for you. There could be explosions. You cannot continue to do that. They wander away, and he's still there. And 36 hours later, he moves this one boulder, and he hears his son cry out. And he says, son, you're alive. He said, oh, and it turns out there's all sorts of kids under these boulders. He said, I told everybody that my father would not give up until he could find me. Is that a great story? It's a true story, by the way, out of the Armenian earthquake. And Max Lucado says, this is what God's love is for us. That while everyone else gives up on us, everybody else tells us to no longer focus on us, God's love continues to reach down to us and to save us. Max Lucado is a great writer, but nevertheless, great story, again, about God's love and how that is to be applied in our lives. Let's look at the next section here, and that is we pick up now in verse 8. love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall fully know, even as I have been fully known. So now faith, hope, and love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love. Again, a very famous passage, but let's see if we can unpack some of the things there as well. And as he transitions now, he's moving from the idea of these gifts and love into the fact that love outlasts all of these gifts. That the gifts that they prized the most in Corinth, many of which we're going to talk about next week in chapter 14, prophecy, tongues, and kind of the gift of knowledge or wisdom, that he now says are insignificant, if you will, in terms of the long-term permanence of love. And so now he's moving from the actions of love to the permanence of love. And so he first of all starts with this idea that what? Love never ends. He's trying to compare the temporal nature of some of these gifts to the permanence of love itself. And two of these gifts, interestingly enough, apparently are some of his preferred gifts. We'll look at that next time in chapter 14, verses 1 through 40. But these three gifts are specifically named, but I think they're representative of all the gifts, some of which he's already talked about in chapter 12. But now in chapter 14, he will pick up those as well. And then he starts talking about that never fails, but then he talks about these will what? Pass away. And he uses that phrase, pass away, it's a Greek term for pass away, three different times, just again to say that they will not last forever. Matter of fact, it's quite possible that you could make the case, and what we do at Dallas Seminary is that some of those gifts faded away for a period of time. And so this is certainly the case. And these gifts will not survive the transition from this age, certainly into the final fullness of this age. Not only are the gifts temporary, but they're also partial, he talks about here as well. And those prophecy and knowledge are highlighted as being what? Incomplete. These partial things will pass away when the fullness is experienced. And when does the fullness take place? Well, that's when Christ returns. Then he provides two illustrations to make his case about temporal and permanent. And the first one is childish things into manhood. And that is, he's saying that again, we put away childish things. Now you look at some of the toys in some of our homes, you say some of our boys never really grew up into men, but nevertheless, we'll leave that for another day. But by and large, we do put away certain childish things and then have adult things. So the idea is Christians are supposed to move from immaturity to maturity, and these spiritual gifts are really intended to aid that process. And if you're taking some notes, you might put down Ephesians 4, verse 11 to 16. In the interest of time, I won't go there, but it seems to imply in that other list of gifts we talked about last time, that one of the things the spiritual gifts do is lead us to what? Spiritual maturity. So the first illustration is from a childish thing to an adult. The second illustration, you have to understand some of the archaeology. And so here, if nothing else, I thought I'd take you back to ancient Corinth. It turns out that Corinth, ancient Corinth, was very famous for these bronze mirrors. And this is one from a museum, which obviously is now turned green, but you can imagine if you had a mirror that would shine very brightly, you could actually see your reflection. Now, that's not as good as a mirror that has glass, so you would see your reflection dimly. The illustration I could use in the modern sense, if you walk down a mall, you will notice that some women, sometimes as they walk by a window, they'll look at each other and they'll start combing their hair. It's not because they saw something in the window that they wanted to buy. It's that they saw enough of the reflection that they could kind of see if, you know, they would straighten themselves out before they move on. And so they sort of see in that mirror, what? Dimly. But then if they go into where they actually have the fitting room, then they have the full-length mirror where they can see themselves, what? perfectly. Likewise, what he is using here is an illustration. Any of the wealthy people in Corinth would have one of these bronze mirrors. And this is the best picture I could find to show you what they look like. And so when they would see their reflection, it was pretty good because they could actually tell how they looked, but they were still seen in a mirror, what? Dimly. And he uses this same illustration here to say that the gifts are only partial. We can see a little bit what heaven is like. We can even see what Jesus is like by the manifestation of some of these gifts within the body. But those are like seen in a mirror dimly. But we eventually will get to see him what? Face to face. And that will be like seeing that full-length mirror right there in the dressing room where you can see every flaw that you didn't want to see in the first place and how everything looks on you. But that, again, is what he is trying to explain in terms of that second illustration. The gifts will no longer be necessary as the things we have known partially, like prophecy and knowledge, because now we will all know each other fully. There is a very good application here, but I would highly recommend that if you haven't thought about what it would be like to be in heaven and what it would be like to be in the new heaven and new earth, let me commend to you the book by Randy Alcorn called Heaven, because he goes into this in great deal of what it would be like to have full knowledge and full understanding and full access to all of the spiritual gifts. See, right now we have access to one or two spiritual gifts. Can you imagine if you have a new body and you have all the spiritual gifts? That gives you a little bit of an idea what heaven's like. And as James McDonald said one time here in the church service, you don't want to spend too much time talking about what heaven's like, because if you really understood what heaven was like, you'd start crossing the street without looking both ways. You know, you'd start jumping out of airplanes without a parachute. You would start rope climbing, climbing a mountain without ropes. You know, I mean, you understand how incredible that will be. And here, Paul is trying to give us just a little bit of an idea of what that might be. Well, then he concludes with one of these famous passages about faith, hope, and love. And he places love as the preeminent goal of the believer, even above faith and hope. And the commentators here have said, basically, he's not making a theological statement about faith, hope, and love. Rather, he's just using this triad of faith, hope, and love to talk about the fullness of the Christian life. And among all things that identify a believer, love is to be the greatest. They will know that we are Christians by what? By our love. And so we certainly should manifest that. Faith and hope are obviously foundational elements of the Christian experience, but even they will not be needed when we're into eternity. For the Christians and for us, this means that the true indicator of maturity and spirituality is love, not the exercise of those temporal gifts. Did you learn something today? If nothing else, you got to see what those bronze mirrors are like. And so what I wanted to do is now spend a little bit of time talking about how to apply this. And it fits very well with some of the things that we've just been talking about, because we've, again, had Gary Thomas with us today talking about Cherish, which, by the way, is such an outstanding book. His Sacred Marriage book is perhaps one of the best-selling books out there, more than 1 million copies in the country, and I think a couple million copies worldwide. But this new one on Cherish is also well done, and we're going to see how that will connect with some of the things we're talking about. Because the studies I'm going to quote from for just a few minutes actually focus on marriage, but the principles apply to any relationship that we are talking about. So as we go through this, you might be thinking about your relationship with your parents, whether they're alive or not, or the relationship you have there, your relationship with your peers, your spouses, your siblings, maybe even people in the neighborhood. And what we're going to talk about is the issue of conflict. And there's all sorts of reasons for conflict, different goals and perspective, financial disagreements. We're going to talk about why there is conflict based upon certain kinds of personalities. And so I'm going to pull some of this from a book by John Gottman. John Gottman is Jewish. You probably, if you've ever seen a TED Talk, he has some of the most popular of the TED Talks, and did research many years ago when they were videotaping couples considering getting married, and he would watch them and he would do analysis, and he began to come up with predictions. And he was able, with 94% accuracy, to predict whether a marriage would fail or succeed. It's the kind of material I sometimes want to hand out in our before you say I do material, because if you go through this, you can begin to see that certain ways in which you communicate actually raise the conflict or lower it. And so he found these presented, actually were present in couples even before they got married. So obviously we're talking about the issue of marriage, but what he found is that relationships often fail because people are unable to resolve certain conflicts. And so this is true not only in the marriage relationship, but think about your brothers and sisters, unless you were an only child. Think about your relationship to your parents. Think about maybe your relationship right now with your boss or with other people in your workplace. And we're going to look at some of those areas of conflict. And what I want to do is add to it a newer book that has come out by a Christian. And that is Scott Stanley is at the University of Denver, but he's a very strong Christian, and his researchers took some of the research that John Gottman had done and put it in this book called A Lasting Promise, A Christian Guide to Fighting for Your Marriage. Now, if you've ever heard Gary Smalley, he's no longer alive, but when he was alive, he used to talk about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the four horsemen of conflict. He's taking that from there. If you're familiar with Dave and Claudia Arp, they've written the dates for mates. They all are pulling from this. So I'm taking you back to kind of some of the basic research. Are you ready for that? And so what I'm going to do is help you understand how they use different terms. John Gottman uses one set of terms. Scott Stanley uses a different set of terms. But they're really talking about the same kind of thing. And what we're going to do is focus on what I will call four corrosive factors that are really instrumental in tearing individuals apart. And this is true for marriage, and so if you're married, you certainly want to pay attention to this. But even if you're not married, this, I think, helps you understand why there are certain kinds of conflicts in individuals. And so I'm going to go through these four, and I'll end on time because we want to make sure we have time for the meeting and also for lunch. But if nothing else, what I wanted to do is take you through each one of the four. The first is called escalation. And that's what Scott Stanley calls it, but instead John Gottman calls it contempt. Now, if you were listening just a few minutes ago, you might have heard the interview where Gary Thomas said, what's the opposite of cherish? Contempt. Okay, so you can see how that connects up very easily. And so that is the first one. The second is invalidation. Scott Stanley calls it invalidation. But John Gottman refers to it as criticism. As you probably can tell, I kind of like Scott Stanley's definitions a little better because they are a little fuller, I think. The third is what is called negative interpretation, or what John Gottman refers to as defensiveness. And then the final one is this idea of withdrawal and avoidance, which John Gottman calls stonewalling. Now, if you can see in your handout, I've already given you those terms, but now we'll go through each one of those four, and I'll try to not only explain it, but this is where I think Scott Stanley's done such a good job. He gives us Bible verses to go with that. So if you're taking some notes, you can kind of follow along, and then this is actually a Bible study that you can engage in this week as we talk about that. So the first one is what? Escalation. I think we all know what that is. You know, it starts with you left the cap off the toothpaste, and it devolves into your mother wears army boots, or even something worse. Actually, a lot worse, usually. Escalation occurs when partners, and we'll look at marriage for a minute, but it applies outside of marriage as well, when two individuals respond back and forth negatively to each other, and they're continually upping the ante so that the conversation gets more and more hostile. You ever seen this before? You've probably seen this with your mother or your father at some time, right? You've probably seen it with your brother or sister. And if you're married, you probably have seen it with your spouse. We know how all of a sudden it starts here and real quickly it gets up here. Now, if you look, I want to put down some key verses. I thought one very good verse, and I won't go into all the verses that Scott Stanley uses, but one I thought was good is 1 Peter 3, verse 9. Do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult. Okay, when somebody insults you, do you repay that way? There is an escalation. We have a current president that I think sometimes in his Twitter accounts does that, right? We have seen that certainly to in other circumstances as well. And this is what happens with escalation. One, you know, you shoot at me, I shoot back at you. What happens is sometimes it's just one shot. Okay, no big deal. But when the negative comment increases, the level of anger and frustration do, and soon a small disagreement blows up into a major fight. Been there? I see a lot of head shaking. So, you know, we've seen this unfold in our lives. So let's talk about some examples of escalation. Here's example number one. A major shouting match erupts over a small conflict, and angry words damage the oneness in a marriage or the friendship in a friendship, especially when a spouse or another individual threatens to leave the marriage. And I thought a great verse for this would be Proverbs 12, verse 18. Reckless words pierce like a sword. You know, you've heard the phrase when you were a kid, you know, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Whoever made up with that phrase? Really? If I were to break us into groups right now, and maybe one time we'll do this in the future here, we'll break into groups, maybe you can just share some of the hurtful things that were said to you in grade school, and the fact that you're at 50-something, 60-something, 70-something, how much higher do I have to go here, that you can still remember these says how damaging those words are. You may have wanted to pursue a particular career and somebody said, you're not going to be any good at that, and you just turned around and never considered it again. You may have had parents that said, you know, you're never going to amount to anything, and you spent most of your life trying to get out from under that. I can remember some of the worst things that my basketball coaches used to say to me. And the other day, interesting enough, I got a little Facebook post that said, I didn't realize both my coaches were still alive, by the way, and they were doing, they're inducting a number of athletes that I played with, but also the two coaches that I played under, both JV and the other one, in this kind of Miramonte High School Hall of Fame. And I thought, I'd like to go just to say something to them, but I won't, you know. I mean, we've all had those situations. People have said awful things. And, you know, you run up and down the court and you're going, I can't believe I just heard that about myself, you know. And so this is the idea of escalation. Well, just as that can happen on a ball field, just as that can happen in a business environment, it also happens in marriages and in relationships. So this is one example of escalation. There's a different kind of escalation. I've had some people say, oh, we don't fight like cats and dogs. We get along. We've never raised our voice to one another. But then you hang around the dinner table with them and you go, yeah, maybe you don't raise your voice, but there's just one, you know, jab after another little sharp jab, maybe a little bit of kidding, what they used to say, kidding on the square, where you're just sort of being semi-facetious and making fun of people, but I'm just kidding, you know, and you just see that kind of escalation taking place as well. And so I thought a key verse there would be James 1, verse 26. Couples must control their emotions and their tongues. And in a minute, I'm going to talk about how to turn this around. And obviously, the way we apply 1 Corinthians 13 love is that we don't let things escalate. I've been in situations, even in a boardroom recently, where things just sort of escalated a little bit. And I thought, you know, I've got to find a way to de-escalate that particular set of circumstances. Otherwise, there's going to be more shouting between two directors at each other. I go, okay, we don't need to have that happen. And again, that is why I think James 1 is so important in terms of learning how to control our tongue and control our emotions. But we'll come back to more of the application in just a minute. The second one is invalidation. Invalidation is a pattern which one partner subtly or directly puts down the thoughts, the feelings, or even the character of the other individual. So invalidation actually in some cases is intentional. If you've ever seen the BBC TV series Sherlock Holmes, the kind of things he says to Watson, Dr. Watson, or those kinds of things. Or it could be unintentional, that is, it's just trying to be helpful. And so I'm going to look at two different examples of that. First of all, it can be very caustic, very sarcastic. Well, I'm sorry I'm not as perfect as you. Or I forgot how lucky I am to be married to you. Or, you know, I'm so glad to have a boss like you that looks out for my best interest. You know what those kind of things are. And those are obviously a direct attack on the person's character, on their personality. And, of course, that's going to destroy the relationship. But, again, sometimes invalidation can be almost Christianized. Think about this. This is where, again, I think Scott Stanley, in his book, does a good job of helping us understand that we sort of do that in the Christian world, too. That is, somebody's really going through a tough day, and we come up and say, well, it's just not that bad. You know, for those of us that go to hospitals, not a good idea. You know, it could be a whole lot worse. You could have cancer. You know, this is not a thing you want to be saying in a hospital bed, okay? And, you know, you're still alive, you know, but we sometimes don't know what to say, and we say just the worst thing possible. Or just trust in the Lord. You know, if you just learn to trust in the Lord, then you wouldn't feel stress in your life, right? No, I think even Paul felt stress in his life, especially when he was being stoned, when he was being whipped, when he was being left for dead. You know, these statements invalidate the pain and the concern of another person. And the best verse I could come up with would be in Proverbs 25, verse 20, where Solomon, King Solomon, refers to that as singing songs to a heavy heart. You know, there it's okay. You know, if you just trust in the Lord a little bit more. You ever been on that side? If you're on the receiving end of that, you sort of want to hurt the person after a while if they say too many of those little Christian cliches. So invalidation might actually come from a person who's really trying to do good but just not helping at all. And if you want to find another good example, I would say that the book of Job, his three what were called miserable comforters would fit into that category. Okay? Two more, real quick. Negative interpretation. What's negative interpretation? That's where one partner consistently believes that the motives of the other person are more negative than really is the case. And this can be really destructive because it quickly erodes a pattern. Just recently I was telling somebody I was going to swing by and just see how they were doing, and the person said, "Oh, so you're going to check on me?" And I thought, "No, actually I was coming to try to affirm you, but now I'm not showing up because you're assuming that because I'm showing up I'm going to check on you." Actually, I'm just trying to tell you, you know, it's just amazing how quickly people jump to the negative interpretation. Another kind of negative interpretation is mind reading. When you assume you know what your partner is thinking or why he or she did something. And again, a key verse if you want to put down in your notes would be 1 Corinthians 4 verse 5. Because here, Paul is warning, as we looked at just a few weeks ago, the possibility that we might be jumping to conclusions. And he really warns us against attempting to try to judge the thoughts and motives of other individuals. You know, it's not a good idea. And so negative interpretation, as you can imagine, is where an individual simply comes to the conclusion that you are doing something out of bad motives. And so that can be very, very corrosive. The final one would be withdrawal and avoidance, what John Gottman also refers to as stonewalling. There's two aspects of this. They manifest themselves in slightly different ways, but it's where the partner is unwilling to get in, stay in a discussion because it's too threatening. Withdrawal is an obvious one. That is, person getting up and leaving the room. You know, you can see that. You're having a conversation, they just get up and walk right out the door and go, excuse me, we're not finished here. You know, you've been down that road, right? Or sometimes where they're turning off or just shutting down. I have one colleague that, because I suspect he grew up around a lot of anger, that as soon as things get a little bit hostile, he just kind of shuts down. He just doesn't say anything because he doesn't know what to say. And maybe shutting down was the only way to stay safe in the family. And so it's harder to draw him out if things get a little bit more contested. And so in this case, the withdrawer may agree quickly to that. So they may not leave the room. They may not shut down, but they go, okay, whatever you say. Yeah, that's fine. Okay. I think it's a bad idea, but you know, we're just going to do that. That's still an aspect of what? Withdrawal. Avoidance is different. That's where we put up the do not trespass signs. They're just certain things we are just simply not going to talk about. And they're oftentimes really good at not letting the conversation take place in the first place. If you watch any of the talking head shows, which I do kind of for a living, you'll see that you'll ask a politician something, and they'll just go right over here. And they go, wait a minute, we're supposed to be over here. We're supposed to be, and then they just change the topic. I remember years ago when I was speaking at Princeton University with the Princeton Evangelical Fellowship, we had a number of feminists in one of the presentations I was doing. And at the end, some of the people that invited me came up and said, "You actually answered every one of their questions." I said, "Well, that's what you're supposed to." He said, "No, most of the time people avoid that. As soon as somebody raises something difficult about the Bible or about Christianity, they just, you know, say some other verses or change the subject." And I thought, well, okay, that's what some people will do. And a person who is prone to avoidance would prefer that the topic not come up. But if it does, then they begin to oftentimes manifest the signs of withdrawal that we just described. Okay, so that we can end on time, how do we deal with some of these issues? And again, to apply some of these 1 Corinthians 13 love principles, let's go back and look at escalation. It seems to me that in a marriage or in a relationship, a person who really wants to show the kind of love that is here, patient and kind and does not boast and is not arrogant, is not rude, it seems to me that you would not return insult for insult. You would be able to control your emotions. I gave you James 1. You'd be able to control your tongue, and you'd recognize, as we talked about in Proverbs, that we would not repay insult for insult. Or also we could use in the book of Romans, it talks about that we would overcome evil with what? Good. So we would have biblical principles by which we would de-escalate the situation. This is something they're teaching right now in the police force. A big issue, you know, how can you de-escalate a situation? Any of you have ever gone through a concealed carry, one of the things they take you through is how you can de-escalate a situation rather than pulling your weapon. And so that's important not only in a marriage or a family or a business, it's really important out there for the people in law enforcement as well. So obviously we've given you a couple of biblical principles about controlling your emotions and controlling your tongue. What about invalidation? Well, it seems to me that the obvious thing is you validate the relationship. A different way of going about that might say, okay, I understand why you're saying that. I may not agree, but I understand why you say that and why you feel that's important. That's very different than you have no right to that view. You see the difference? And so you can still speak the truth in love, but you can validate the person even if you disagree with what the person might be saying. That would be a good technique for a lot of people to learn on Facebook right now. But nevertheless, again, another illustration about that. Okay, negative interpretation. This is one of the more corrosive ones. Interesting, if John Gottman says perhaps the most corrosive is number one, which he calls contempt. And I would say that we just learned about we need to cherish, not have contempt. But the second most corrosive one, and sometimes the most corrosive one, is negative interpretation. Because if you're around an individual that always assumes the worst about you, you sometimes can never crawl out of that hole. But if you're one of those individuals that actually assumes the worst about individuals, then let's go back to recognizing that Paul warned us in 1 Corinthians 4 to maybe not be so quick to judge the motives of other individuals. And then finally, withdrawal and avoidance. Well, the obvious one there is to stay engaged. You know, and there are counselors that will say, sometimes will say, look, there is one rule here. You can't get out of that chair. You have to stay in that chair. If need be, I'm going to lock that door. You're not going out the door. We're going to solve the problem in this situation. And so staying engaged. And sometimes when it's really painful, it's hard to stay engaged. So it's easy to say they need to stay engaged, but you need to also stay engaged as well. Well, there's a lot more I can say, but I again thought if you would want to read a little bit more about this, I did probably give Scott Stanley a chance to sell a whole lot more books, because his book, A Lasting Promise, A Christian Guide to Fighting for Your Marriage, has been out for a number of years. You can get it on Kindle, I believe, and you can get it for your Nook and some things like that. Or, again, there's a printed copy, and if you can't find one, I'll be glad to lend you my copy, which I have. But if you want to also maybe just to go through this a little bit more detail, we did put all this on the screen, but I, on the Probe website, probe.org, did a week of radio programs on Scott Stanley's book called Why Marriages Fail. And I go into a little bit more detail in all of that. So you could go to the Probe website, which is just one more resource for you as well to have advantage for. So if nothing else, I've tried to put some shoe leather on all of this, because it seems to me that we can read about 1 Corinthians 13 and that love is patient and love is kind, but how do we apply that? So I wanted to give you at least a few ideas about how to apply 1 Corinthians 13 in the relationships you have. Parker?